Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome back to the DMZ, everybody.
It's good to see you. It's Thursday morning. We're having a nice spate of global warming here in northern DMZ. I remember not too long ago it snowed on the last week of October. Right now it's, you know, we've been in the 70s last few days. I don't know if it feels fall-like in West Virginia or not.
Well, today's going to be a beautiful day, Bill. Cool in the evenings, cold at night. It's going to get up to about 75 here today. One thing I am concerned about, I just interviewed Ross Douthat, who has a memoir out about Lyme disease. It's a really good book, by the way. But, you know, he got it in Connecticut, but he tells me that if global warming trend continues, that it could be, you know, it could be spreading. So...
The warmer weather ticks are out longer. Ticks are almost year round. You know where we are, that is one of the many many byproducts of global warming. But interesting that Ross is on Team Science.
I mean it is interesting, right? It's an unintended consequence is the wrong word, but it's an externality that you might not think about, right? Is something like Lyme disease spreading into geographically other parts. I mean, I think it has, but it's still mainly concentrated, I think, in like the Connecticut area. And we don't need it to go anywhere else as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, there's plenty of it, you know, around, you know, beyond New Connecticut, you know, all New England. But I think Lyme is present, you know, good, you're not, it's not so contained. It's,
That's
but
true.
Anyway, that is where it was first discovered.
I do recommend the book, and it was a harrowing experience. It's been a harrowing experience that he has endured. And also, we talk about Bill. I don't know if you saw the clip. He was interviewed by the Secret Service. He had tweeted something like a joke movie clip about Trump. The Secret Service showed up at his house, searched his house for guns, which is crazy. I don't know if he talked about it at the time or if it's just now coming out, but wild stuff. And be careful what you tweet.
it's Thursday morning. Why one other weather thing to ask you before we get into, you know, serious business.
Let me just say the humidity is not good for this hairdo. That's my biggest concern right now.
When is it the right time to see peak West Virginia foliage?
Well, I would say it depends on what part of West Virginia you're going to. But the part of West Virginia that I'm in, which is near Harper's Ferry, we are still not there yet. We're probably a couple weeks off. But I think if you're in other parts of West Virginia, it may be right now in some parts.
I've only had to see peak foliage in West Virginia once, and it may be sacrilegious for someone who lives in New England to say, but I do think West Virginia has fantastic foliage.
It's a beautiful state. You know, John Denver might have been full of shit when he was talking about the Rocky Mountains, but not when he was talking about almost heaven, West Virginia.
Thursday morning. It is October 21st. We are 10 days away from the second deadline set by Nancy Pelosi to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill and implicitly the reconciliation bill, Build Back Better, as well, though no one believes they can actually pass Build Back Better by the 31st. The attempt now seems to be to try to get a framework of Build Back Better and then try to say that's sufficient to get progressives to come along on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. It's not wholly arbitrary to pick that date because the Highway Trust Fund is now set to expire on the 31st. It was set to expire September 30th. Congress passed a 30-day extension. Can't they do that again? Sure, but Republicans in the Senate would have to cooperate. And it's not clear that they would if another extension would cost money. From what I've read, and maybe, you know, cash flows can surprise, but it's not a certainty that there'll be any money left in the trust fund that you could reauthorize it for free and still be able to pay out to state and local infrastructure projects. So if Republicans say, hey, I did it for you once, I'm not going to do it a second time. If you want this so badly, go pass the infrastructure bill because that has the extension in it. It would seem Republicans could do that. So do you think, Matt Lewis, that Democrats are on a track to actually getting something done in 10 days? Or do you sense that's going to be, you know, a giant cluster?
I don't see any reason to believe things are going to get better anytime soon, to be honest. I mean, you never know, but I don't see any evidence to support that.
I mean, you do have in the past 48 hours, I mean, the first 2 weeks plus of this month, there was no movement at all. It was just Manchin and Sinema digging in their heels and progressives venting and the White House practically being silent. And then just in the past couple of days, you're starting to see the White House lean in saying, hey, look, guys, Biden told groups of moderates and progressives, this is what I want. And which is effectively, you know, an army of trial balloons. And now you're seeing a lot of scrambling with moderates and progressives saying, oh, wait a second, that's what you want? Well, that's not going to sit well with me. It needs to be this, 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 or this. You know, so it's not like they're not at the precipice of consensus, but there's much more movement in the past couple of days than we've seen in negotiations than we have perhaps this whole time.
Someone I was talking to recently made an interesting point, though, Bill, and it's that in the past, when you've had a political party that had sort of two holdouts or two people that you have to, you know, sort of corral, like Collins and Snow, that they were pretty much, they wanted the same thing. So if you could meet their demands, you could win both votes. But the problem with Sinema and Manchin is they want very different things, not necessarily mutually exclusive, but you know, Sinema seems to be focused on taxes, whereas Manchin doesn't care about taxes, it seems like. Manchin obviously cares about coal, and I don't think Sinema cares about that. So, but I'll defer to you. What do you make of that analysis?
What I would like to know is, I mean, what I think that's correct, and I wrote a piece earlier in the process laying out that not just Manchin Sinema, just moderates in general, moderates in the House and the Senate have communicated different things about what they want. Back in August, when we had the Gottheimer posse hanging up the budget resolution vote, you had a larger moderate caucus, the New Dems, laying out a different strategy and not trying to hold up the budget resolution vote. And simply trying to make their case for what they want to see and build back better. Much of that is dominating the conversation today. Should we do lots of things for shorter time frames or fewer things with longer time frames? It's the New Dems that first put out the argument for fewer things, longer time frames. A lot of this is provincial, you know, regional. You know, Gottheimer wants salt. Other moderates don't really care about salt. Manchin wants stuff for fossil fuels. Sinema probably doesn't care as much about that because she's in Arizona. She seems to care about certain business tax rates that Manchin's sort of business-friendly centrist, but has a bit more of a populist, you know, twist to it. And it seems more comfortable with raising certain tax rates or taking a chunk out of pharma. You know, Bob Menendez in New Jersey, a lot of pharma in New Jersey. Bob Menendez just came out and said he's not for the drug pricing plan. So the notion that's just Manchin Sinema is not really accurate. Just a lot of these folks don't speak up as much as Manchin does or has been as obvious as Sinema has. So that's always been a complication here, that there's not a singular block of people represented by a singular voice who you can negotiate with. You have to negotiate lots of individual things in a bill that's composed of lots of different individual things. It's a very complicated bill. What sort of baffles me is why this process didn't start so much sooner. Why was there so much inactivity? I mean, again, we don't know everything that's going on behind the scenes. But it sure seems like, just based on the venting, the public venting that's been going on, that not a whole lot was happening behind the scenes on these fronts when there was so much work to do.
Do you agree with the notion that in the past there have been, when there have been holdouts like this, there were generally like blocks of votes that you could pick? If you made a compromise, you could pick up two or three holdouts, as opposed to that this is a more complicated problem than normal when confronting like legislative challenges.
More complicated, but wholly foreseeable. You have very, very narrow majorities in both chambers, and you're trying to do an incredibly complex, multifaceted bill. You have to know that any individual person or small group of people can raise their hands and slow you down. So you got to get on that very early if you want this to happen by a certain date. And you know, outside of the Highway Trust Fund issue, there was no firm date required to get this passed. I mean, the other deal hanging out there is the expiration of the child tax credit expansion and the enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies. That expires at the end of the year. Outside of that, there's no deadline forcing action. When there's so much work to do, you should not lollygag it.
You lollygag the ball to first base. You're a bunch of lollygaggers.
Again, I hate to be a peanut gallery guy. We don't know everything that's going on, but it really feels like there were foreseeable problems here that were not addressed as early as they could have been. I mean, and not saying that they can't work out at the end of the day, but I think there's more than a zero chance that we're going to get to 1031, and we've had now a three-month stretch, nearing a three-month stretch of Biden having no good days, no good headlines, from Afghanistan to COVID to the border to supply chain, debt limit drama, and just the general dragging out of these Build Back Better negotiations. And Biden's still mired in the mid-40s. Do you really want to go over the highway cliff? Do you really want to, I mean, again, granted, you know, it's not like everything stops short on November 1st. It's not like every road project stops and everyone drops their equipment. It's not that abrupt. But it makes the cash flow to states and localities become uncertain. And you will probably get complaining from governors, mayors, county commissioners, et cetera, you know, departments of public works, saying, I don't know how to budget for the next year because I don't know when this money's coming. While you have ongoing supply chain problems, which Biden himself and Transportation Secretary Buttigieg himself have said, we have stuff in the bipartisan infrastructure bill for ports, for freight rail, that will help with supply chain issues going forward. Do you want to be the Build Back Better party that is having infrastructure money dry up? I think that's a risk. And again, maybe Republicans throw them in our lifeline. But if they're not, does Biden get enough of a framework, enough of a tentative deal with Manchin and Sinema and others to go back to the House well like he did last month? And last month he said, hey, we got to do these things together. This time does he come in and say, hey, we've moved the ball down the field a lot. We have a good amount of commitment from Manchin that they will do something here. We can't let this money get disrupted. I need you to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill today. Now, if he does that, there's no guarantee he gets any Republican votes in the House. And there used to be some hope that they get a chunk. Maybe it's more than one. I don't know. But he can't. I don't think he can
chunk,
count on it.
When you say a chunk, wasn't there like 30 or something?
It's debatable whether that was really in hand or not. We never had names. You know, Brian Fitzpatrick said, I thought I could have gotten 40, but now I'm not so sure. Do you ever really have 40? Who knows? I think Biden certainly can't go into the House with any assumption he's going to get one. He has to really keep the caucus fully unified. He can only lose no more than three if it's a trick party line vote. And look, AOC, Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush, there's three right there who you might say, I can't count on those three. You would need Jayapal. You would need Ayanna Pressley. You would need Mondaire Jones. You know, there's people that I think you would need to have say, look, we got to take what we can get here.
Not to beat a dead horse, but if Biden had done this from the beginning, I think he'd be in a lot better shape, right? I mean, if he had, we're going to pass this bipartisan bill, you would have gotten some Republicans votes, and he could have basically said, like, we're doing this, and then we're going to turn to the other one and, like, don't cripple my presidency, and kind of dare them to vote against it.
Well, I think everyone would have been better off if this drama never began in the first place, if progressives never made a big deal about the infrastructure bill. They said, hey, you got something done. Great, let's pass and move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Have a basic amount of trust that Manchin and Sinema would not leave Biden hanging. Now, what's happened in the past few months, on one hand, has strengthened the progressive assumption that Manchin and Sinema were not to be trusted, that they had to hold the bipartisan infrastructure bill hostage, or else they would have gotten nothing. They would have stabbed him in the back. But I would argue that, one, you've never heard Manchin or Sinema say, I don't want to pass Build Back Better. The Manchin has said he wants something on tax reform.
Right. Let me ask you this, Bill. Do progressives view the bipartisan infrastructure bill as bad in and of itself?
Some do.
They'd rather not do it at all. They don't view it as an incremental gain.
Some progressives, I'm not saying it's most or a lot, but there are some who have vocally said, AOC has been on record, that say it's a negative bad, that is bad for climate. It does not help with emissions. Now, there's others that say that is a marginal help. So, again, it's not a uniform position. But there are people that say, look, we don't want to pass this, and we only will do it if you pass the bigger bill.
So I
think they would have been better off with trust. They would have been able to keep the temperature lower. I wrote a piece for the Monthly, Washington Monthly, this week saying, what's the evidence that dragging Manchin and Sinema all this time and treating them as adversaries, treating them as corrupt, shaming them in public, what's the evidence that has really worked? If your standard is, well, we would have gotten nothing, and now we're going to get something. You know, I mean, I celebrate that pragmatic attitude. I think, as a general rule, something is better than nothing. That's really not been how progressives have gone about these negotiations, both this particular one and in general. It's not like they were patting Obama on the back for his something better than nothing arguments for the stimulus and for Wall Street reform and for healthcare. They've really complained that he didn't negotiate hard and settled for less than he should have. Progressives were on record saying, you know, for Bernie, it should be $6 trillion. For AOC, it should be $10 trillion. Jamal Bowman said anything south of 5.4 is unacceptable. When I heard Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush on CNN just this week say 3.5 is the compromise. That was the talking point for a good long while after the budget resolution got passed. So I find it hard to accept that if they end up at around 2, possibly lower than 2, and the progressive spin is, well, it's better than nothing. I mean, look, again, it is better than nothing. I mean, I on one hand, I salute progressives for being flexible in that regard. They should be pragmatic and should accept half a loaf. But as far as analyzing, hey, what tactics worked and what tactics didn't? What should we replicate going forward? What are good models of negotiating strategy? We can't fully assess until we're done. But considering that everything in the past month has been going in Manchin and Sinema's direction, we're not jacking anything up. We're taking things down. Treating your key votes shabbily in public does not strike me as a good tactic. Now, again, it might depend on the people involved. Maybe other people would be softer targets. Maybe other people in different states or different personalities would have wilted under pressure. I mean, look, and it's not illegitimate to have thought, hey, you know what, you know, Manchin, you know, he's a tough cookie, he's West Virginia. You know, we can only do so much with that guy. So it was not illegitimate for progressives to go to Sinema in Arizona and say, hey, you're going to get a primary challenge. This is a blueing state. Look at these poll numbers. Your poll numbers are sinking. You know, this strategy of yours, this notion you should be a maverick, it's not working out. You got to change course. I mean, it's not a crazy argument, but she didn't budge. She doesn't wilt. She as far as I can tell, she's made up her mind about either politically what is the right positioning for her, or substantively what she actually believes in. You know, she, you know, back in 20, you know, some people are stunned that she is resisting apparently any corporate tax increases. At least for the overarching corporate tax rate, she might accept other things, you know, separate from that. But back in 2018, when she was still in the House and running for Senate, she'd already voted against the Trump tax bill in November 2017. Then a bill came on the floor to permanently extend the individual tax cuts because the Trump bill had sunsets. And she was one of three Democrats to vote yes on that. And then she said, the problem I had with the bill originally was the sunsets on middle-class families and small businesses that use pass-through, you know, wrapped up in the individual tax rates. So she was signaling back then that she was running, you know, more of a center-right path than people, I think, were appreciating. Remember, also in that race, she said she wasn't even going to support Chuck Schumer for majority leader. I mean, and look, it's not like I looked at those things and assumed, well, she's more conservative than I thought. I mean, like most people, I thought these are performative acts to try to help you win an election in a purple state, and what had been a red state up until that point.
Yeah.
But maybe she doesn't really mean it. She's not really going to be that difficult as a Senate Democratic Caucus member. But the signs were there, and you know, some people I see, you know, she's portraying what she ran on. I'm like, that's not what she ran on being, you know, fairly center right. So don't assume she's really going against how she ran, what people in Arizona assumed she would be.
She's going against what we thought she was lying when she told us she was a center, right. A centrist. Right. So she's right. Going against our perception of her as a liar. We were hoping you were a liar. We really were hoping you were a fake. It turns out it reminds me of, there's a scene in Rocky I where, you know, remember Apollo Creed picks Rocky Balboa, the Italian stallion, as like a stunt because he's Italian, is on Columbus Day or something like that, or Thanksgiving, I don't know. But whatever, he picks Stallone, he picks Rocky as like a patsy just for a show. And there's a scene, Rocky comes out and is like starting to actually, remember Rocky doesn't win that first fight. It's actually a split decision with Apollo winning. But at one point, Duke the trainer turns to Apollo and says, he doesn't know it's a damn show. He thinks it's a damn fight. And I think there's truth to that. Like, we thought that like cinema was like putting on a show, and like she thinks she's actually telling us the truth, right?
So by the way,
Duke is an underrated, I think, character and actor. I'm a
fair
Duke
enough. So I just think when we do the after action report on this whole episode, for progressives, you know, as mad as they might be at Manchin, assuming, you know, probably a lot of people's takeaways is going to be let's have better Senate majorities so we don't have to be so reliant on them. Maybe if they get primary, they lose their election in 2024, so what? They were no good for us anyway. You know, that to me is that's more of the self-serving conclusion. You need to ask yourself what works and what doesn't as far as achieving your policy goals. I mean, we did a whole lot of this after Obama, and a lot of people had these takeaways that, well, Obama didn't fight hard enough, and Obama didn't, you should have pushed the Overton window more, and he shouldn't have been so naive about bipartisan compromise. And Democrats, you know, up to Biden and Schumer and Pelosi have largely eschewed bipartisan compromise as far as their bigger things. I mean, a fair amount of bipartisan things have happened, including the infrastructure bill. But they decided to put the lion's share of their agenda on the partisan shoulders through reconciliation so they wouldn't have to do what Obama did. I think they'll get something. I'm not saying the reconciliation path was a terrible path, but it's certainly not nearly as simple a path as I think people thought it was going to be going in, because it's not a lockstep party. It is an ideologically diverse party, especially with narrow majorities. It was still going to require awkward compromises. That if you get a bunch of things that have these short time frames, like, you know, apparently Biden floated child tax credit for 1 year. Child tax credit is a very expensive line item, but it's also become a signature achievement of the Biden administration so long as it sticks around. Richie Torres commented yesterday, you do this for 1 year, what happens if you lose the House? And then you don't get you get it again before 2024. I mean, it's such a good point. You wonder how serious the trial balloon is. But it does show how complicated this negotiation is and how going the partisan route is not as simple as it sounds.
Yeah. And there could be some immediate political ramifications, right, for the failure that Democrats have had. And we're seeing it here, there, next door, in the state of Virginia, where Glenn Youngkin is running now tied, according to the latest polling, with Terry McAuliffe for the gubernatorial race in Virginia. And like, why does this matter? It could be a bellwether, right? I mean, I think if a Republican wins in Virginia, which has become sort of a blue state, if a Republican wins, that has a chilling effect, I think, on other Democrats going into the midterms, making it less likely you would pass any new legislation. And, you know, I think McAuliffe would probably prefer it if Democrats went ahead and passed that bipartisan bill like yesterday.
Oh, he said so publicly. I mean, McAuliffe has made this an issue, which in my mind, it's almost a little weird. It's one thing for McAuliffe to, you know, call Biden privately and say, hey, I can really use your help here because your numbers are dragging me down. I think this will give you a boost and me a boost. But he's made it a public issue. Because he's clearly worried that Democrats are seen both in Virginia and nationally as the incumbent party. And so if you're mad about status quo, you're mad at Democrats. So please do something so people aren't mad at Democrats and don't take out their frustrations on me, even though I was a governor for a term and I was a popular governor. So I think that is one other factor that could lead Biden to, you know, put his thumb on the scale in the opposite direction, you know, within a couple of weeks.
He's really running out of time. And like I said, this could be, you know, this thing could snowball, because if Biden doesn't, now I'm not saying that the bipartisan bill is going to put Terry McAuliffe over the top, but it would show some momentum. It would show, it's, you know, take the W, right? Mm-hmm. But if Biden doesn't do that and McAuliffe loses, then it probably becomes harder, not easier, for Democrats to pass anything going forward, right? Because that would have a chilling effect.
I mean, if McAuliffe loses, I mean, you could interpret it different ways. You could say, well, we should have got that passed. Let's get something passed. We would have that problem again. Or you could say Democrats have been overreaching and we suffered for it, so we better scale back our ambitions. And the problem is that probably both those schools of thought will be present. It makes it harder to get to a compromise. So it will be a whole lot easier for Democrats if they pass something and McAuliffe won, they can move on to the next thing. It's not unusual for the president's party to lose an off-year election. In fact, the unusual thing was Terry McAuliffe winning in 2013, when Obama was president. That was what broke tradition. And it was a strong signal at how blue Virginia was getting. Virginia was getting so blue that it wasn't susceptible to the pendulum swings of the off years. And since that point, I mean, look, you've had consistent, you've had Democrat governors in Virginia, I think going back 20 years, except for one term, the 2009 Republican win. You have two Democratic senators in Virginia going back several years. You've had Democrats winning Virginia at the presidential level since 2008. This has been a very blue state for the last 10, 20 years. And so for it to be suddenly susceptible to political wins and be and return to a purple state is a more serious warning sign for Democrats than that might have been if this happened in the Clinton era.
It's a much bigger signal, you know, much bigger signal than it would have been then.
And it also seems like Youngkin, I think on the show, I was very dismissive of Youngkin because he was so tied to Trump. And I argued this is a blue state and a blue state that's not going to be so amenable to someone who has said publicly that he supports Trump. But it does seem like Youngkin has done a more craftier two-step than I gave him credit for. Not that it means he's going to win, but he certainly made this much more of a race than I would have expected. And again, I'm not on the ground that you probably see Virginia TV more than I do. But my understanding is that the Youngkin ads, and he's self-funding, or really a good chunk of it self-funding, he's done a lot of ads that don't tie him to Trump and make him seem more like an everyman than I would have assumed he would be able to do.
Yeah, I think he's running a pretty effective campaign. He's probably like almost the perfect candidate for Virginia right now. He's someone who he's loaded. He's kind of a Mitt Romney, Tim Pawlenty establishment Republican. You know, obviously he's running in this off year, which until McAuliffe defied history would suggest that it's sort of a check. Virginia would check the national zeitgeist a year later. So he's got a lot going for him. You know, I think that there was a big misstep about a week ago where Steve Bannon did a rally for the Republican ticket. And Trump phoned in. And they did a pledge of allegiance to a flag that was flown at the Trump at the nonviolent Trump rally on January 6th. And Youngkin had to distance himself from that. But by and large, he's been able to really thread the needle. He's been able to keep the Trump people on board by, I think, talking about things like critical race theory and education. But he's also been able to not come across as menacing or crazy. So I think people like me, I don't live in Virginia anymore, but like if the election were held today, I would vote for Youngkin in the election. People like me who may not have voted, you know, for Trump, and Amanda Carpenter, let me say Amanda Carpenter at The Bulwark has a piece kind of making this argument that kind of suburbanites, Romney-type voters are going to come out and vote for Youngkin. Henry Olson has a piece at the Washington Post, and he was on my podcast talking about how Youngkin's tax policy has been more populist than, you know, the Romney era of like, you didn't build this, you know, rewarding the rich, that Youngkin has a more populist tax policy. So I think Youngkin has been populist and Trumpy in the sense that he's adopted populist tax policies in the sense that he's been able to capitalize on the culture war issue of critical race theory while simultaneously coming across as sort of just a normal, like generic Republican. And if you take that, if you take how bad Biden has been doing the last few months and you put it all together, he's tied. And he very well could win the election. And if he does, again, I think there will be consequences down the road.
Now, I had a piece in the Monthly several weeks ago, actually focused on Loudoun County in Virginia, arguing that the whole critical race theory thing wasn't going to work for Republicans, especially because places like Loudoun are places that have gone red to blue. They have college-educated suburbanites. These are people who are pretty open to having race being discussed in schools. And you know, Trumpers are, you know, sort of fighting, you know, the last war and you know, screaming into the wind. If Youngkin wins, obviously that's not gonna make that piece look very good. But if McAuliffe still wins, and if he wins because he wins in suburban, I mean, Democrats have won in Virginia not because they win rural Western Virginia, it's because they dominate in the northern DC suburbs and increasingly in those exurbs like Loudoun County. I do think the jury's out whether those culture war pleas are going to ultimately win the day for Youngkin. we'll find out soon enough. But if he wins and how he wins is going to be very important to determining that.
Totally. And I think, I don't know if it's going to work, but I think the strategy of like appealing to Trump voters by virtue of things like that, without being Trumpy, doing it sort of in a nicer way, that's the test, right? That's what he's attempting to do. Like, will it work? I don't know. I will say this. If he loses narrowly, I don't think it would be fair to conclude that it didn't work. He shouldn't, Youngkin shouldn't be in, should not be in this race. And so the fact, I would say, and you know, this is a point that Henry Olson made to me, the Washington Post columnist Henry Olson made to me during a recent podcast. But if Youngkin comes close, Democrats should still, if he just comes close, that in and of itself should still be a danger sign to them.
Well, you know, it's going to be hard to separate factors because there's other things going on here that's not just about critical race theory issues or transgender issues in Loudoun County. So if you are trying to turn blue places back to red, and the culture war attack, you still come up short. I mean, you might be able to say, hey, you know, I made some headway. There are some right-leaning Romneyites who didn't like what was happening in Loudoun, so I got them back. I still might say, you know what, you know, a loss is a loss. You know, you clearly need more than that if you're actually going to win back places you've lost, because this is an increasingly polarized country, culturally speaking. And the trend on these social issues is generally away from Republicans in these college-educated areas. So that wouldn't strike me as being fertile territory to keep hammering at if you came up short here.
All I'm saying is I think this is a very interesting test, right? Because the Republican Party is grappling with how to operate in the shadow of Trump when Trump won't go away. And what kind of candidates should they run and how should those candidates behave? And the problem is, if you criticize Trump and disavow Trump completely, if you completely disavow Trump and all that he stands for, you lose his supporters. You can't lose all of them, right? On the other hand, if you embrace Trump, then you alienate all the people who were very reliable Republican voters, you know, for a long time. Who were kind of like educated suburbanites who were not going to support that. And so this is a test to see if the right kind of candidate running a campaign that's like a kinder, gentler, temperamentally kinder, gentler, but still hitting some culture war issues that honestly could have resonated with or without Trump. Like, that's the test. Will it work in a, you know, in this interesting environment, which is like on one hand a difficult environment for a Republican, right? Because it's now a blue state, but on the other hand, a favorable environment because of the off year and because of Biden's slagging popularity. So it is going to be like, I just, you know, for whatever, whoever wins, like, this is worth paying attention to.
I also don't know to what extent, you know, McAuliffe had what I think we feel like described as a gaffe when he said, and this is in quote, literally verbatim, you know, parents don't get a say in, you know, what's taught in schools. You know, that was an overbroad comment. And I mean, I think in most schools, it's not literally true. Parents elect school boards. And I mean, school boards determine curriculum, but parents elect those school boards and go to, and those are public meetings and they have public comment sections. And so they do have a role to play there. I'm not saying there's an argument that they shouldn't, but as far as a matter of plain fact, it's not the case. You know, I mean, it's one thing to say a small group of parents screaming at a school board meeting don't determine what's in, determine it gets taught in the classrooms. Maybe it's what he meant to say, but it came out, I think, too bluntly and too overbroad. And
I think it's like a Kinsey gaffe, potentially. I mean, it does expose, I think, kind of a worldview, like a progressive technocratic worldview that, like, they know what's best. And I think it reinforces that negative stereotype that some of us have toward liberals and Democrats. So it's very unhelpful, whether he meant it or not, not helpful.
So, you know, that aspect of it, I think, you know, somewhat complicates, you know, does critical race theory work as a political wedge issue? Maybe if you say a dumb thing like parents don't have a say in what gets taught at kids' schools, there might have been a better way to handle that that wasn't as defensive sounding that would have been able to blunt that attack.
I think one thing is for sure is that the idea is you have to have a culture war issue, because that is what is moving the needle nowadays. It's not sort of old fashioned left versus right political philosophy policy. It's something that what would Fox News be talking about, right? And that's the kind of stuff. So that seems to be correct. And I think it's certainly Youngkin's. In the old days, somebody like Youngkin probably wouldn't have been delving into these kind of issues or trying to make hay of them as much, right? And I think that's the new model.
It still strikes me as a dangerous game for Republicans to play, because not every cultural issue redounds to their benefit. And if it's literally all you're doing, and it seems like you're not keeping
it. It shouldn't be all you're doing. I think it's part of.
I mean, it's a lot of Republicans doing, from the abortion stuff in Texas to CRT and transgender issues in Virginia, to the fact that Republicans have very little to say about the bread and butter agenda that Democrats are trying to push through in Congress right now. I mean, the only other issue that I hear Republicans talking about beyond abortion and critical race theory and transgender issues is, did Trump get was the election stolen from Donald Trump? I mean, there's not a whole lot about what helps middle-class families in their day-to-day. And it may be that you can take something like critical race theory and transgender issues and tie it into your school and make it feel very personal to certain parents and get their dander up. But I just think as a general play, I mean, we know that certain cultural issues tilt Democratic, particularly with college-educated suburbanites who had been Republican voters. We know this from 2018 and 2020. So it's hardly a slam dunk play for Republicans in every situation.
Yeah, I think I will say a couple things. Like, so for one, I think the reason this works is that in Virginia, I think the reason it works is that Youngkin, stylistically, temperamentally, is more like a Tim Pawlenty, and so he's already sort of naturally kind of a wonky guy who wants to talk about tax rates. And so that is sort of who he is. And then he's broadening it out, adding in this culture war stuff that's in the zeitgeist, but he's doing it in a way that feels more authentic. He's not trying to act like Trump. He's not trying to be Trump. That wouldn't work. So he's found a way to talk about these issues that at least seems, authentic. I also think, and we had this discussion before, that there is an increasing number of what I would call, like, particularly white college educated suburban folks who I think have been radicalized by the left on issues pertaining to their children. Their children's education, the cancel culture. And these are folks that I do agree in the olden days, meaning 10 years ago, would have been turned off by culture war issues. They were more liberal. I think things are changing amongst this cohort. And I think that is partly what's happening in Virginia.
Well, we'll have more data to look at in less than 2 weeks to try to assess these theories of the case. Anything else that you want to talk about or anything you want to plug?
I would just circle back and plug the interview I did with Ross Douthat that we talked for over an hour. I'm going to hold it up. He wrote this memoir called The Deep Places. And it's basically about his 6-year battle, to use the Marshall term that we talk about in our discussion, with Lyme disease. And it was pretty crazy. And he got involved in some very interesting alternative holistic solutions to try to to try to help him feel better. And really interesting discussion. How about you, Bill?
As I said, I think I had two pieces this week so far. So I had the piece in the monthly about the wisdom of dragging Manchin and Sinema, and a piece of the real clear politics on why the infrastructure bill might well pass by October 31st because of some of the factors that we talked about on the show. And I am working on a piece regarding transgender issues in Loudoun County. So I won't give too much away just yet. But that should, I should be finishing that up today. So maybe that might run, I don't know, be this week or early next week. Something else for us to talk about on the next show.
Sounds good. But we're not just going to have to wait for the next show to talk. Am I right? We're bringing back the Zoom. We still got a couple weeks. We should do a Zoom before Halloween where everyone dresses up in a costume or something.
That's asking a lot.
That's asking a lot, yeah. Well, anyway, we're going to Zoom. I've cleared my schedule.
Okay.
You.
Okay.
So you just let me know what time you want to do it.
Well, we probably could do four then, for Eastern.
We could, yeah. Yeah, we could do four. Let's just, let me let me clear that with the wife, but I think that'll work.
Okay.
Either way, we'll do tomorrow afternoon. And you can go to patreon.com/BillShare or patreon.com/MattLewis and sign up, and you'll be invited to these things.
All right.
Yeah, it'll be a good conversation. It's been a while, so I look forward to catching up.
So till tomorrow in the Zoom, until next week in the DMZ, I'll see you then.
See you, Bill.